Right, I would like to call the House Education Committee to order. Today is March 6th, and it is 8:08 a.m. Today we have present our co-chair, Jamie Allard, Representative Jamie Allard, Representative Prox, Representative McCormick, Representative Hemshoot, Representative Story, and myself, co-chair Ruffridge. And so we do have a quorum to conduct business. Did I miss somebody?
I said Ruffridge.
Oh, Ruffridge, yes. I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to silence or turn off your cell phones. And the staff that will be assisting us today are Jake with House, with the LIO, and Linda with House Records. And we have the following items on our agenda today. First, we are going to hear from Mr. Scott Jepson, an appointee for the Board of Regents. And we are going to take up House Bill 71 for its first hearing. And then we'll have a second hearing on HB 75 or HB 65, increasing the base student allocation. Is there anything from the committee before we get started? Seeing none. All right. Well, Mr. Jepson is joining us online today, and he will be coming in as the voice from the heavens. So are you with us, Mr. Jepson?
Yes, I am. I did discover a technical problem on my side. If you'd like to try Teams one more time, we could try that.
Oh, this is fine. Just to have you call in, and you can hear us fine, and we can hear you. So whenever you're ready, you can begin introducing us to you. Thank you.
Okay. So good morning, Co-Chair Allard, Co-Chair Ruffridge, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Jepson, and I live in Anchorage. This morning, I'd like to start out with just providing you a summary of my professional experience, and then I'll conclude with comments on my interest in continuing to serve on the Board of Regents. I moved to Alaska in 1982 and have lived here for 33 of the last 41 years. My son, Trevor, attended UAF where he received a petroleum engineering degree and is currently working in Juneau for Representative McKay. I received BS and MS degrees in chemical engineering from the University of Texas at Austin in 1980, and after finishing my formal education, I went to work for ARCO in Denver. After several years in Denver, ARCO offered me a job in Anchorage, and I jumped at the opportunity. The 80s were a good time to be involved in North Slope oil development. There were highs and lows in oil price, but it was still early days for Prudhoe Bay and Park. In the oil patch, there's no better job than working on new oil fields. In 91, I was offered a chance to move to Midland, Texas to manage ARCO's oil and gas fields in Wyoming, New Mexico, and Colorado. I took the assignment because I knew I had to leave Alaska to advance in the company. It was tough leaving, though. I remember wondering if I had made a mistake and if I would ever get the chance to come back. The Texas assignment was a good one. I managed operations in a number of states and was able to be part of a startup company called Vastar Resources. Vastar was majority owned by ARCO, and its IPO is listed under its own symbol on the New York Stock Exchange. In 97, I had the opportunity to come back to Alaska to manage the Kuparuk Development Organization. I took the job and from that point forward made it known to my management that I did not want to leave Alaska. Over the next 26 years, I was fortunate to have a number of different interesting assignments. Besides the Kuparuk job, I led the technical effort to sell ARCO Alaska, which was a condition of BP's acquisition of ARCO, managed ConocoPhillips Cook Inlet business, including the Kenai LNG plant, was seconded to the Denali project, which, as you may recall, was formed to build a gas pipeline for Lower 48 to monetize North Slope gas. And I ultimately ended up leading ConocoPhillips External Affairs and Pipeline business. In March of 21, after nearly 41 years with ConocoPhillips and its predecessors, I elected to retire. And I don't intend to leave Alaska. I've also had the opportunity to serve on the University of Alaska Foundation. I joined the foundation board in 2011 and turned out in 2020. My tenure on the board gave me the opportunity to see the contribution of the university and meeting the job needs of Alaskans in the state. About the same time as I retired, I applied for an open position with 2 years remaining on the University of Alaska Board of Regents. I applied because I realized the importance of a quality state university in providing Alaskans the opportunity to get a good education in their home state that will qualify them for Alaska jobs, and I believe my background and experiences helped manage the UA system to achieve that goal. As my initial term came to an end, I gave a lot of thought as to the reasons I would wish to continue to serve on the Board of Regents. When I first came onto the board, I believed that I would only reapply if I thought I could be influential in shaping the policies and strategies that would help the university succeed. after serving on the board for the last few years? I believe the answer to that question is yes. As a board, we have a positive yet challenging dialogue with the university administration about the problems and opportunities facing the university. I believe my opinions and perspective have been useful in shaping decisions. In conclusion, I'm more passionate and optimistic about the future of the University of Alaska than I was 2 years ago. But my goals for the university have not changed. If I am confirmed, I will use my experience and background to help the university become stronger, stable, and with a strategic vision for the future that recognizes the fiscal pressures on the state, but also the requirement for universities to serve the needs of the state's residents for higher education and the needs of the greater Alaska community. That concludes my comments. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Jepson. Is there any questions from the committee for Mr. Jepson? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge, and thank you, Mr. Jepson, for your interest in serving again and for your past 2 years serving as a Board of Regents. I'm very curious, as in your last 2 years, can you share with myself and the committee here something strategic that you have worked on that you believe is shaping the university in a positive direction?
Sure. There are a couple of issues that are, they're critical to university, and one that I think everybody is highly aware of, and that is the issue of enrollment. As a regent, I've had a lot of conversations with some of the management at the university about what caused the drop in enrollment that we've seen from about 2014 through really about 2022. There is no silver bullet there. There are lots of theories about why enrollment has declined and a lot of analogies to national trends, et cetera. But there isn't anything that one can really point to other than the fact, I think, that we've seen fewer students going to school after high school on an absolute basis. And we've seen the folks who take the non-degree programs who are just coming in for the odd course, they've fallen pretty consistently as well. But the focus I'm trying to bring to it is we need to start looking forward. We need to start trying to determine what it is that we can change this trend. And to the credit of the universities, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Southeast, they have put programs in place over the last few years that have tried to reverse this trend. And UAF in particular has been pretty successful. As a regent, what I think we can do and what I am trying to do is to bring focus to this. Typically, the way we look at things like enrollment is we see statistics. Has it gone up? Has it gone down? Has it compared to previous periods in time? The problem with that is, though, that's a lagging indicator. One of the things that I'm advocating for now is I want to monitor the programs that the universities have in place, monitor the progress that they're making against the various actions that they're taking to help increase enrollment. And also just the fact that we have this conversation at every meeting where we discuss university business brings a lot more focus to it and elevates the importance of it to the university. Other things that I'm looking at, I'm trying to champion on the Board of Regents, is how can we raise additional funds outside of our traditional means? Traditionally, our funds come from things like overhead recovery, tuition, UGF monies. What we really need to do is see if we can broaden our sources of revenue. Maybe some of these things won't turn out to be significant contributors, but maybe they will. For example, at UAF, we do not receive much in the way of revenue from the intellectual property that we generate as a result of the research that goes on up there. A lot of that research is government-funded. UAF owns the intellectual property that comes from that research, but we really haven't put a significant effort into trying to monetize it. I'm not saying that it hasn't been a topic of conversation in the past. It has been. But we simply haven't put a lot of effort into it. My goal now is to raise this issue at the Board of Regents level and work with the university to put more effort into that. I think we can do better than what we've done. Another area that I think can be improved and that we can advance for particularly UAF is in the area of research. I think if we can bring University of Alaska Fairbanks up to a Tier 1 research institute, we can do a tremendous amount for bringing additional research dollars in, which will enhance the status of the university, which should also increase the desirability of the university for students, both in-state and out-of-state. those are a couple of examples. Other things that I've been, that I advocate on quite a bit as we have our budget discussions is just trying to bring to bear the point that Alaska has fiscal constraints. And as a university, we need to make sure that the budget that we submit and the way we run the university fits within the budget constraints of the state. At any rate, those are a couple of examples that I've undertaken in my term as a regent.
Thank you. Is there a follow-up, Representative?
One follow-up, please. Thank you. Through the chair, I feel it's important that the regents have a good relationship with the faculty and the staff. What would you say you have done in that area?
Regent Story, through the chair, I've met with the governance groups on for both the staff, faculty and staff. Open to any of them that want to meet with me and talk with me. And I think have a good relationship with those. It's an open door relationship. And I think I agree with you that it is an important element for the university and for the regents. We have a shared governance model where we take input not just from the administration, but also from the faculty, also from the staff and students.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Story and Mr. Jepson. Other questions for Mr. Jepson? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Thank you for your work with the university, Mr. Jepson, and thank you for being willing to step forward and put in additional time. I guess I'm interested a bit in the drone program that the unmanned aerial vehicles that the university is pursuing. What sort of opportunities do you see with that program going forward?
Representative Prox, through the chair. The goal of the unmanned aerial vehicle program, the drone program at UAF, is to pioneer technology that will allow us to transport goods, potentially maybe even people, although I think this down the roadways, to remote villages throughout Alaska. Right now, that tends to be fairly expensive. I think the promise of drone technology is it can make it more reliable and make it less expensive. UAF is really a leader in this area across the country. They're one of the top research universities for trying to pioneer this technology. I think it holds a lot of promise for Alaska. It also holds a lot of promise for aviation in general.
Do you think there are some intellectual property opportunities with that associated with that research?
There could be. I don't know how much of what we're doing is inventing the technology versus testing the technology. I think right now most of our emphasis is on testing the technology to prove it up in the field. But anything that we do invent obviously can be intellectual property that we could potentially license to others.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Representative Prox?
Nope.
All right. Representative Himshu.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge, through the Chair, Mr. Jepson. This is a question that I ask people when I just want to get a feel for where they are in a situation or in the business that they operate or department that they run. So my question is, when you think of the university, what keeps you up at night?
So what keeps me up at night are a couple of things. One, we absolutely need to change the trend in enrollment. Right now, the state is providing a fairly substantial subsidy on a per student basis. I don't think that's tenable long term. That's one of the things that keeps me up. The other thing that bothers me some, because we don't have a solution to it, is just tackling deferred maintenance at the university. We have about $1.5 billion backlog. Not all of it is critical. The university is not shutting down, but we have to come up with a way to try to address this. Some of our buildings are pretty old. Take a look at Fairbanks. Some of them have safety issues. So it's not a high-profile element for the university. It's not one that garners a tremendous amount of attention outside the university system and potentially with the legislature, but it is something that bothers me that we don't have a solution to at this point in time. Those are probably the two things that I think are some of the highest priority items for the university that keep me up at night.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Hampshire? No? Other questions for Mr. Jepson? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, have you explored or thought about some opportunities for the university to increase interface with the K-12 education system and other vocational programs?
Representative Prox, through the chair, we do have two regions that are on the Post-Secondary Education Council, and that's primarily where we interact, I think, with the K-12. Really, we have our focus at the university is trying to make sure that if students don't come into the university system prepared to take advanced courses, we can help prepare those kids for those opportunities through additional classes we have at the university. But we don't have a specific mission or focus on K-12 other than through our relationship with some of the other commissions for the state.
Follow up?
No, thank you.
Representative Ballard.
Thank you, Mr. Jepson, for stepping up and willing to serve. I know that sometimes the public could get attacked in certain areas, even though we're volunteers. Could you tell me what your thought process is or where you stand on school choice?
Co-Chair Allard, my perspective on that is a personal perspective, and I don't really want to confuse that with Board of Regents policies. It's not something that we as regents have taken up and don't have a position on. So, I don't want to not answer your question, but I really don't think that it's one that is something that impacts the Board of Regents.
Follow-up, Representative Allard.
Thank you. I appreciate your perspective on that. So I guess my question has a lot of relevance to do with the Board of Regents, as that if school of choice does go through or passes, I want to know how you feel about kids not coming to the UA system or any other college system in the state based on they didn't go to a traditional public school brick and mortar. I'd like your professional opinion.
Co-Chair Allard, I'm not sure I follow the connection between school choice and the university system. I'm not aware that school choice really is something that's an option at the university level.
Thank you.
Representative Story?
Yes, thank you, Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, Mr. Jepson, when you were talking about deferred maintenance, I just wanted to pass on that this last week I met with three students from the university governance, student governance team, one from Fairbanks and two from UAS, and they were both concerned about deferred maintenance and how it impacted their learning environment. So you have some student voice with you on that. They're concerned too. And so I just wanted to pass that on and thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Jepson from the committee? I do have one, Mr. Jepson, just in regards to students graduating or attending the UA system, particularly in regards to developing for our workforce. Do you happen to know how many students attend the UA system and then stay in Alaska to work? What is the success rate of our UA students?
You know, I don't have that percentage at my fingertips. I can go back and look and see if that data does exist. We have talked about it in the past. I just don't recall if we have that information. But I do know from personal experience, though, and I know this from my time working at ConocoPhillips, is that when we hired students from the University of Alaska, they stayed in Alaska. Our problem with hiring students outside is that they typically would go back to wherever it is they came from after a few years in Alaska. You know, the primary job market for our graduates is Alaska, so most of them are going to get hired here. How many of them stay after 5 or 10 years, I really don't have a good handle on.
Okay, well, that was kind of the answer I was looking for. So in your opinion, University of Alaska students typically, if they want to stay and work in Alaska, that is something that can happen pretty easily from your experience.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Allard.
Mr. Jepson, this is more of a comment, and I would encourage you to look at school choice, and perhaps you could reach out back to me and maybe understand why that question is so important as a Board of Regents member.
Okay, I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Jepson.
All right, any other questions for Mr. Jepson? If it's on the left side of the room, I can't see you due to the amount of sunshine flowing through the building, which is great. All right, seeing none. All right. The House Education Committee then has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and then recommends the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration, and that name is Scott Jepson, the nominee for the University of Alaska Board of Regents. This does not reflect any intention of any member of this committee to vote for or against this individual during any further session for the purpose of confirmation. Thank you, Mr. Jepson, for your time this morning, and we will take a brief at ease while we transition. We are back on record with the House Education Committee, and we have like to welcome Representative Galvin and Representative Ortiz to the audience. We also like to welcome Representative Rauscher. And first hearing on House Bill 71, an act relating to education and relating to a school district online checkbook. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Representative Rauscher, District 29. And I'd like to thank the Chairman Ruffridge and Chairman Allard and members of the Education Committee for hearing this bill. House Bill 71, an act relating to education and relating to a school district online checkbook. The school districts around Alaska spend millions of dollars each year without a clear understanding of where the money goes. We believe it goes to everything from office supplies to teacher salaries, administrative workers, and hopefully the kids in the classrooms themselves. A tool like an online checkbook will help the governor and the legislature understand where the deficits are and where funding is needed. Public accountability helps ensure that funds are spent wisely, and the public is entitled to understand where the funds actually go. The intent of the online checkbook is to create a free, searchable website that provides Alaskans with easy access to detailed and comprehensive information on school district spending. This will encourage better understanding of district needs and ultimately help ensure that funding is directed to where it should be. Currently, the state of Alaska has an online checkbook, and I believe the city of Anchorage, I think they have one. But anyway, I'm going to turn this over to Ryan McKee, who's my chief of staff, and he could do the short section.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. Yeah, this is a pretty short one. Section 1, AS14. .17.910A. This section adds that each school district shall make the financial records available on an internet website that is accessible and free to the public.
Thank you. Does that conclude your presentation?
That's it.
Excellent. Short and efficient. Any questions from the committee for Representative Rauscher, bill sponsor? Representative Hemshut.
I hope this is the right time to ask this. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I see a zero fiscal note, and so the expense of open checkbook would fall to the districts because it's not free to – I mean, this is software, right? Oh, my goodness.
brief eddies. Back on record, Representative Rauscher, would you like to repeat the question, Representative Hemshut?
Sure, through the chair. The question is this software that a district would need to purchase?
Representative, for the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair to Representative Hinshu. When I said the word free, I meant to the public, to where they would get on it and it wouldn't cost them anything to actually, you know, like there's a lot of websites that make you put some money up just so you could be a part of that. That's what I meant by the word free. But you're correct in stating that it won't cost the state anything, and you're correct in stating that it would probably cost the school system whatever it would cost to actually get transfer the information from their checkbook, which is already probably in bits and bytes, to the public to view. I hope that answered your question.
Follow-up, Representative? Okay.
Do you have a sense of how, just in my hometown of Sitka, we did this for our city, and there were a lot of snags and snarls in getting the files to talk to each other to make it available, and so there was quite a bit of personnel time as well. But just the software alone, do you know what that would cost?
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Hinshut, I imagine every school district is going to be different due to their size, due to their location, due to their internet, due to the software the actual administration of the school runs on. So to have a definitive answer for you, I cannot provide that at this time. I think there's like 52 school districts. 54. And so I don't have that that definitive answer for all of those.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I guess I've looked at the state online checkbook that's been there for, 20 years almost. And it didn't provide information that I found helpful, too much detail. Do you know who you expect would be using this information in a useful way?
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, to Representative Prox, I'm going to suggest that legislators will, and that the governor will, and that I imagine even school board members would probably have some use for it, besides the parents. And I would imagine all of those that I just mentioned.
Follow up, yes. Through the chair, do we have, I believe that the school districts are supposed to submit their budgets to the Department of Education, State Department of Education, and then they go through a public process. I'm trying to understand what value this would add in addition to the accounting and reporting that the districts also already provide.
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Prox, I think two different things. When we see a budget, it's basically large numbers and there's a lot of grouping going on. But when you have an online checkbook, the check is written out for pens for the entire district or whatever. I'm just guessing. You will see that check in the ledger somewhere. And so that's basically what an online checkbook, my opinion of an online checkbook, should look like, if that is any kind of answer regarding your question.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Allard.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher, bringing this forward. I think this is super important. I want to know there's two questions through the chair. One, is there a time frame that you're looking for this to be implemented?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, for the record, through the chair, Chairman Allard, excuse me. I think that there is no direct timeline for this, so it would ever be either 90 days from the time it's passed or the governor signs it before that is, I believe, how that works if you don't have a timeline on there.
Thank you.
Well,
yes, thank you. It was like pulling teeth the last couple of weeks in order to get information from the school districts about their financial. I can't imagine sitting here as a representative and how difficult it is for the public. So I want to say thank you for bringing this forward, and I think with some tweaking, this is really a good thing. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair Ruffridge, and through the Chair, thank you, Mr. Roucher, Representative Roucher, for bringing this forward. I think it really has merit. I know the school districts have to provide this information for their public audits. I am concerned about the amount of personnel time it may take the school district to transfer the information, but my question is, have you talked to your superintendent or the school board's associations and the superintendent's association to find out if all this information is easy to transfer, if they will need software, and what the costs might be to the districts? And if not, it would be great to have that information in our next hearing on the bill.
For the record, Representative Rauscher, through the chair to Representative Story. I did talk to our school district when Dr. Traney was in my office, and we did not cover your question directly. So I can tell you I will approach them with that and the school board members and see. Actually, there was a school board member in my office too. We did not mention that, but I can find out for you if that's okay. And next time we meet.
Thank you. Other questions for the co-sponsor? I just had one. So is this a district, so each district would have its own website dedicated to this, or this would be potentially held by, this would not be held by the Department of Education on a singular website searchable by each district? It would be on each district's website? Is that the intent of the bill?
For the record, Representative Rauscher, to the chair, Chairman Ruffridge, I believe it's each district. It will not be by the administration itself. It would have to be each district, according to the way it's written at this present time. And I'll refer to line four. Each district shall maintain complete financial records of the receipt and disperse of the state aid. Disbursement of the state aid. So I believe that's an individualized statement there.
Okay, thank you. Representative McCormick.
Thank you, through the chair. So I was curious, was there any consideration perhaps for having this be through the state as opposed to putting this on the districts? I guess I just have some concerns given lack of access for broadband and that sort of thing, and the type of cost that this could potentially put on the school districts that I represent.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair to Representative McCormick. I did kind of look into that a little bit, and I kind of thought, well, the state's going to write a check to each one of the districts similar, and so you're not really getting the depth of what I believe the parents are looking for. And with the ask for an increase in BSA, with the public's interest on what our kids are, how the money is being applied, whether it's being applied to kids in the classroom or not, I believe that this was the timing for this was just right. But I also believe this is the information that they're all wanting, and not just to understand what each school district was given by the state, because I don't believe the state could go for any further than that if the state was to run the checkbook for them, if that answers your question.
Follow up?
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Seeing none, thank you, Representative Rauscher. We will set this bill aside for a hearing at another date. And we will take a brief at ease while we transition to HB 65.
Thank you.
At ease. All right, we are back on record. It is 8:47. We are joined by Representative Dan Cortez, and we are going to have the second hearing on House Bill 65, increasing the base student allocation. And it looks like you were kind enough to have another presentation for us.
Very kind.
Very kind. Thank you, sir. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge and Allard. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz, and I represent District 1, Southern Southeast Alaska.
And I'm Caroline Hamp, Staff to Representative Dan Ortiz.
Thank you, members of the committee, co-chairs Allard and Ruffridge, for again hearing HB 65. As a reminder, HB 65 will increase the BSA, or the base student allocation, by $1,250 per eligible student for a total BSA per student of $7,210. I know, members of the committee, that all of us in the legislature have been hearing loud and clear about the difficult decisions school districts across the state are facing in terms of what programs and numbers of staff will need to be cut if we in the legislature are unable to reach a consensus on the need to provide a significant increase to the BSA. For example, for those of you whose districts are part of the Anchorage School District, I know the testimony provided yesterday at the Anchorage Legislative Town Hall was overwhelmingly in support of the need to increase the BSA. In the last meeting, in our first hearing, we discussed the effects of inflation on school districts during the last hearing for HB 65. I have two graphs today to show you that show the realities of inflation on our BSA. The first is the history of funding for the BSA, adjusted to reflect FY22 dollars. Today, the BSA, as the graph shows, is at the lowest it has been in 20 years when you adjust for inflation. Also to note that in FY23 and FY24, they are calculated with an assumed inflation rate of 2.5%, which we know is not nearly as high as inflation actually was during those 2 years. So, again, you look at this this graph that's before you, and you know, it clearly shows that when you adjust for inflation, we are at a low point in terms of providing support for our districts across the state. Not a good place for us to be. The second is a more holistic view of education funding, including local contribution, impact aid, state aid, pupil transportation, and additional formula funding. But again, you see the impacts are the same. Even when you add the extra outside funding outside of the BSA, we are very, very close, in fact, almost identical to just a little bit above where we were funding education back in FY05. And you can see the up and down trends of that funding. Finally, I think it would be a mistake not to remind the committee that not only is it important that we reach consensus on providing a significant increase to the BSA this session, but that we do so in an expeditious manner. The sooner districts know what their funding level will be, the better chance they will have in being able to plan their budgets and to be hopefully be able to avoid handing out as many pink slips to their teachers and paraprofessionals because they once they do know what the funding likely will be, they will then hopefully be able to adjust those severe projected cuts that we're hearing about right now, reduce those pink slip handouts. Because once they hand out the pink slips, even if they find out later on that they're gonna that the district or that the state will provide more funding through the BSA, the slips are out. Those teachers, many of them young, will already have made decisions about moving elsewhere, it'll be hard to get them back, and it'll cost money to get them back. So the best thing we can do is not only provide an increase in funding to the BSA, a significant increase, but that we do so in an expeditious manner so that everybody out there across the state gets the message that, no, we don't have to do as drastic a cuts as we thought we might have to, as it looks like right now for many of them. We can avoid that if we can, if they can just find out soon what the funding level will be. So I know that that's a challenge. Anytime, any type of significant piece of legislation, it's a challenge for the legislature to act in an expeditious manner. But if we do so, we're going to be, in the end, saving districts money, saving the state money in some ways, probably not direct money for the state. But in the end, what we're going to also be doing is helping to provide better outcomes, because the more turnover that we have, the more, you know, pink slips that we hand out and we scramble to reclaim them if there's more funding available, it's just tough. It's just tough to to do education in that kind of environment. It's pretty hard to plan for, you know, how you're going to do great things with the READS Act, or how you're going to do great things in providing new programs and things like that to provide a more educated community of students from across the state if you don't even know what your level of funding is going to be. It's just hard. So I'm asking that this body take a good look at this bill again today, that we can move along the process of amendments and things like that, so that we can do our diligence here on this side of the legislature in moving the whole legislature to an expeditious decision on what we're going to do with the BSA. I thank you again for the opportunity, and I'm totally open for questions.
Thank you, Representative Ortiz, and thank you for bringing this back again. I'm sure that this committee has some questions. Who would like to start us off? Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge, and welcome, Ms. Hemp, and Representative Ortiz. Have you done any sort of analysis on this, the base student allocation, about how much will be going to the fuel increase costs that we've had, the property insurance costs? I know everything is different for different districts, like our district, $800,000 in increased property insurance costs, which can be 8 teachers. Any kind of analysis about the fixed costs that we've known for supplies, for materials, would go to have to be given, and then what is going to be available for, of course, our teacher and salary compensation, and then any initiative for, like, the READS Act. We know to provide students whose kids aren't reading at grade level extra tutoring, Saturday school, after school intervention. Is there any kind of way, magical way, to do this analysis?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I'm going to let Caroline answer that. Do you have an answer to this particular question? But before she does that, you kind of said the answer for us all already. You know, the issues may be quite different in one district in relationship to increased fuel costs versus another district having other issues that they have to deal with. Unique maybe to districts in rural areas compared to or more urban areas. All kinds of different factors can play into how actually each district would use an increase in funding if it were to come. But one thing we do know is that everybody is impacted by inflation. Everybody is impacted by, in one way or the other, or in many ways, their budgets are significantly impacted by inflation. And so that's a known quantity, but in terms of specifics, I really couldn't answer your question. Caroline, do you have anything more to add on that?
For the record, this is Caroline Hamp, staff to Representative Ortiz. It really does differ by district. And as you said, they are fixed costs, so it's not avoidable. We heard last time Representative Ortiz mentioned some statistics about multiple districts, and some fuel increases were as high as 46% in the past year. So we also do, I believe, have Elwin Blackwell, who's the finance manager, the STEED school finance manager, online. I don't know if he would be able to give anything more in depth, but just to let members know that he is available for questions.
Thank you. I guess we do have school finance manager Elwin Blackwell online. Is that something that you would have anything to add?
For the record, this is Elwin Blackwell, school finance manager with the Department of Education. I would have nothing to add. In addition to what Representative Ortiz has shared so far, we do see that costs have been going up across the state and for many of these other fixed type costs. But as far as specific numbers and percentages, I don't have anything available for the committee at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. Follow-up, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I know we have a separate fund for pupil transportation, and I appreciate you acknowledging it here in this chart as a fixed cost going up. And I think it would be worth this committee's look at pupil transportation and seeing if that should be something that we want to increase outside the BSA, which is how it's typically handled, because then that frees up money to go to the classroom, and we're addressing that. And I was wondering if you knew the last year that had been increased, our pupil transportation, and I bet you Mr. Blackwell would know that if the representative doesn't know that. And then I had a follow-up after that.
Mr. Blackwell, did you hear the question? Could you provide me a lifeline, sir?
Mr. Blackwell.
Yes, for the record, this is Edwin Blackwell, Department of Education. The last time that the adjustments were made to the per student cost for pupil transportation, as I recall, it was 2012, and there were some CPI adjustments that were applied for 3 years, culminating in the final CPI adjustment in 2015, and there has been no additional increases in the per pupil cost for pupil transportation since that FY 2015.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you through the chair. Thank you for that information, Mr. Blackwell. Through the chair, to Rep. Ortiz. I know one of the goals is to give some stability, some certainty to school districts as they plan to do a meaningful increase. I am wondering, in this bill, if you thought about carrying, as we've done before, a second year, a two-year bill that would inflation-proof the following year. My concern is we're going to send districts into this roller coaster again after this year by not. I'd like to start the new year just focused on student achievement and not budgets and cuts and just how we're going to strategically use it for instruction. So did you think about doing a two-year inflation-proofing for the second year BSA?
Through the chair, Representative Story, while this particular bill does only address the coming FY 24 year, I'm certainly open to amendments to this bill, amendments that would do that very thing. There's lots of different options we can do when we're trying to decide how to address the BSA. We may, the options are endless, and I'm open to discussion. I'm open to amendments. The main thing, though, is that we address the issue, that we don't just ignore the issue or put off the decision towards the other body. We're our own body. We should be addressing this issue, and that was the main reason why I put the bill forward. I think that would be. I'd be very open to changes in the bill that would address issues like the following year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Allen.
Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Ortiz, in your comments, one of the very first things you said was, we're going to have to cut teachers. And that seems like the narrative. If we say that, it alerts the public, and then it's alarming. Because we have so many buildings that should be closed down to save money there first. So my question to you is, why do you go towards, let's cut the teachers, and what guarantee do we have the funds are going to stay in the classroom? Short answer, please.
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Allard, through the chair reference. Good question. Here's the way I answer that particular question is I used the reference to cutting teachers and staff because that's what we hear about from the districts in their call-ins, in their emails. I think you all were given a stack of emails this morning as a part of the packet where we heard resoundingly from around the state that in order for those districts, mine included, to move forward without an increase to the BSA, with 80% of the funding that goes to districts going towards staff costs, it's pretty unavoidable to not look at reductions in staff without in order to effectively deal with the impacts of inflation, because some things are fixed. You can't choose not to heat a building. You can't choose not to provide transportation, et cetera. Those are not choices. Those are automatic built-in costs. Now, in terms of you, Chair Ruffridge, you used the You used the phrase, there's a number of buildings that could be closed. That I don't know about that in the community that you represent in the Anchorage School District. I don't know about that. And I, you know, so I can't answer that particular question. I know that in my district that they are looking at potentially closing one school and moving those students towards a different building. So they're looking at that. In fact, two of my districts that I represent are looking at that particular option. But that has an impact on education as well. That's not like, oh, you close a school and you suddenly solve the problem without impacting children's education. That's not accurate. And particularly in one of the communities that I represent, they would consolidate into what they now use as their high school for their high school junior high campus, including their, they would then include their elementary students in that one area. But that area has no playground. It has no no facilities that are normally associated with an elementary school. And you know, you talk about the interaction between a kindergartner and a senior in high school, or a kindergartner and a junior high student. What are the impacts of that? Is that the best environment for students to be interacting in that particular manner? Evidently, they're considering that because they feel like that's the least problematic adjustment to the situation that they're dealing with. But is it an ideal adjustment? I don't think anybody in that particular school board from that particular community would say that it would be. So, again, very good question, Chair Allard, and I'm sure that there are some districts that perhaps could reduce some of their costs if they would close buildings or whatever. But that's not when a district uses 80% of their money in general for direct classroom instruction, it's pretty hard to adjust to no increases to BSA without addressing that particular issue and mainly addressing it by reducing staff.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up through the chair. So you're looking at $40 million worth of buildings to be closed to save our state. And we're going to go ahead and cut teachers because that's more efficient?
Through the chair, through Chair Ruffridge, Chair, I'm not sure where you get the $40 million. I really don't know because that might be an Anchorage School District
thing. No, it's statewide. All right. Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Representative McCormick.
If I may be allowed just to make a quick comment. If you shut down schools in some of the communities that I represent, nobody goes to school, period.
Not your district I'm referring to.
Okay. I just wanted to put that out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Other questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, if the, in this case, the state central authority is expected to provide the funding, then it almost seems that we should assume a greater role or a greater part of the management of these districts. And we, as was pointed out by Representative McCormick, we don't have a feel for any of the districts. But should we assume more control and accountability at the state level if we're going to continue providing the bulk of the funding?
Representative Prox through the chair, through Chair Ruffridge. You know, I think the when you look at the history of public schooling, not just in the state of Alaska, but in across the country, I think one of the primary tenets that have been there all along is the idea of local control, the idea that the best government comes from government that's most closely tied to the specific area. And in this particular case, we're relying on our school districts and our school boards to provide that local control, make decisions that are in the best interests of their local communities. And I think most of you have that philosophy, and most legislators have the philosophy that the best government is locally controlled government. Now, does that mean that that it's, you know, not a primary responsibility of local governments and local school boards to provide information about, quote, where the money is being spent to their local communities, to hear input from their parents and from their community members as to how they would like to see school dollars are spent? Certainly that should be a part of the regular process. But I don't necessarily think that we'd become more efficient or we'd be better experts for making decisions about where dollars are spent from the state level and from the state legislative level. I don't know that we know what's best for the community of Kluwak on Prince of Wales as to how they should best use their monies that they have available to them. So I guess I would answer your question by saying we better tread lightly and go slowly if we think that, you know, that it's in the state's best interest or our students across the state's best interest for us to become, quote, more, have a more managerial role of how money is being spent at the local level. I don't know that that would be a good way for us to go.
And before you follow up, Representative Prox, just wanted to recognize Representative Carrick has joined us. Representative Prox.
Yeah, thank you. I'll follow up. I agree. I don't think that it would be, I don't think we'd be any more successful than the local districts, frankly, under the current system of just a formulaic funding. But the it just seems like a flawed concept to be funding by a formula rather than by the, it disconnects the price from the demand, I guess is what fundamentally happens. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't be taking a look at the basic concept of funding it by a formula. And then to go follow up, because we're talking about the base of the formula, but then there's all kinds of factors that result in considerably more money being spent because we have raised the base, and we're not looking at that yet in this bill. Should we be reviewing all of the elements of the whole foundation fund package?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, to looking at the foundation formula and the BSA and how, you know, the different factors that impact the final number that goes to each individual student that is impacted that BSA increase, tall order. Not sure we can get it accomplished between now and the end of this session or the next session, but you know, it's certainly, I think it's always worth looking at and it's always worth examining. And you know, I can see where, you know, you could start that with a joint committee hearing between the education of the other education committee of the other body and this particular body. You know, we could start to look at those kinds of things. But again, tall order and take time. And what we're hearing loud and clear is in this particular situation, because of what you see before you on the screen there, in some ways, time is of the essence. That we start to, we act, give the message, we send whatever message it is. If it's the message that that no, you know, we're not ready to increase the BSA, well, at least they know then. But hopefully we won't come to that particular decision. Again, you know, we are bound by our Constitution, the Alaska State Constitution. And the Alaska State Constitution speaks clearly about the need to provide for public safety and the need to provide adequate and to maintain education funding for students between 5 and 18 years of age. Maintain, I think, is the key word here. If you look at the graph, I think you can make the argument quite clearly that we're not maintaining the needs of for the needs of our students across the state.
Follow up. Thank you.
Follow up. An example. Billions, I guess, are going to be spent on upgrading internet connectivity across the state. That could provide an option for a complete different delivery model of the education service. Should we be dictating how that's going to play out, or require people to take that, require districts to take that into consideration? Planning for the future.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, good questions, good dialogue. I really appreciate these kinds of discussions because they need to be had. And initially, I would respond by saying, you know, with the changes in connectivity, more broadband available across the state, that can't be a bad thing, and it could be helpful to education. But I would also say that there's been very little research out there. There's been very little analysis over the last 20 years as to what's the impact of learning through an online format rather than having the direct human connectivity between a student and a teacher, between a student and a paraprofessional on a regular basis. There's not been much analysis as to the value of that. Does it create new opportunities and new possibilities? Yes, it does. And we all were made very clear of that as we struggled through COVID about at least there was that option, which wouldn't have been there 20 years ago. You know, those districts that closed down for a while, there wouldn't have been much available except, I suppose, maybe families going up to school districts and picking up packets of copied material and things like that and bringing them home. But so is it a good thing that we've had increased connectivity? Yes. And is it a good thing? Does it provide more opportunities? Yes. Or more options? It does. But the question here is, in the long term, are we really doing better for our students and for their needs by becoming more and more reliant on that type of an education format? Rather than, again, the direct human contact. I can tell you through my years, both as a teacher and administrator, over time, yeah, it was important what I was teaching in terms of the content, but really what I was doing was helping to build, in many cases, that child's confidence, that child's feeling of safety, that child's feeling of someone knowing someone who cares about them as individual people. And what's the impact of that? What's the how can you measure that? Really tough to measure, but I think all of you probably can remember that teacher, that moment, that those times when that person provided that something to you that you can still feel today, and that you can still know that's a part of you today. And was that a result of a test? No. Was it a result of some sort of other assessment or something that was taken online or something like that? No. It was about the fact that you knew that person there believes in you, cares about you, knows about your family, all those kinds of things. How do you replace that? I don't know that you're improving education by going towards a less human connectivity model.
Right.
Make sense?
Yeah. Follow up.
It makes perfect sense to me. If it were my opinion, I'd say we should unplug the internet. I don't think that's going to happen, that the world changes. And unfortunately, we're going to have to adapt to that. And then all kinds of other things change. And we can't guarantee something to continue as it always was with everything else changing. That is just not sustainable. That's the conundrum that we face. But I appreciate that you brought this forward and initiated the discussion.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Other questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Permission to share a reference document for everyone.
Please.
The last time the foundation formula was looked at was in 2015 by the legislature contracted out with Augenblick, Palish and Associates to study the foundation formula and look and see if there was a way to improve it. How was our formula? They compared it to the other states' foundation formula. And they found that we had a pretty fair formula, that it definitely should be updated for area cost differentials because we haven't done that in a couple of decades, I think. But they also said we might want to add a factor for kids on free and reduced lunch and a factor for English as second language learners because those students who have a high proportion, those schools who have a high proportion of those students may need extra interventionists, extra teachers to help those students. But that would be a great reference document to just look at to see how that was done at one time in 2015. Thank you.
Perhaps Representative Story could share that with the committee and we will get that distributed. Thank you. Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I've read about Alaska funding schools higher than other states in terms of the total contribution of the state per student. My question to you is, do you know anything about how counties contribute to school districts in the lower 48 where we don't have counties? Are counties a funding body, or is funding in the lower 48 strictly state and local like it is in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I haven't done very much analysis on that that particular question. Like everything, like our districts across the state are different. Counties and states across the country are different. They handle things differently. And I think it varies between state and state. However, I do know also that certainly there's a greater proportion of, quote, what we call organized boroughs, organized counties, organized, you know, other similar entities. States are better down in the lower 48, you know, there's more of a play that the local counties have in relationship and more responsibility that they have in relationship to their schools and their school districts than our state, because much of our state, at least geographically, is unorganized and there's not a direct local tax base to support schools from the organized borough. So in that sense, it's different that way. I'm quite certain that across the lower 48, there's probably very few districts that don't have some sort of local contribution that helps support their schools and their school districts. But again, the specifics, don't know much about it. So,
follow up.
Thank you, through the chair. So just to confirm, while Alaska may spend more per student at the state level, it's possible in the lower 48 where there are counties that state spending is not as great percentage-wise because there's other funding. You're just not sure.
I'm not sure, but I am, you know, if you have looked recently at some of the studies that have come from Dr. DeFeo of ICER, I think that there's quite a bit of study as to this particular question as to what's the real level that we're funding our districts across the state and what's the real level of support we're providing our students. And when you factor things like cost differential and you factor things like cost being higher in rural areas as opposed to urban areas, et cetera, I don't think we do. I think we're And perhaps Representative Story can provide a little bit more information, but we come out not near the top at all when you factor in some of these other things. Again, studies that have done that have come from ICER, Dr. DeFeo, highlight the fact that maybe numerically dollars get, I think we're sixth highest or something like that when you just look at dollars per student. When you factor in all the different factors, it really we're median level at best, I think.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? I have a couple myself. So with the BSA at its current rate, if we were to increase it, it seems to me that there would be a opportunity there to help teacher salaries improve potentially, to help some of our workforce issues. But there is not a mechanism currently by which that would happen. Have you talked to school districts? Is that the intent with some of the BSA if we were to increase it, is to increase teacher salaries? Is that something you're aware of?
Very good question, Chair Ruffridge. I think it is. I believe strongly, because what I hear of time and time again is, you know, we're becoming less and less competitive at being able to hold our certified teaching staff, less and less competitive at providing for paraprofessionals' needs, et cetera. And because, again, most of the dollars that go to districts go to personnel costs, you know, for them, I hear time and time again, it's we're losing people. We are losing particularly our younger people. They can go to any other state across the union where they still have such things as defined benefits. And their average teaching salaries are, in many cases, higher than ours or at least equal to ours, despite the fact that they have lower costs in relationship to standard of living or cost for living and those kinds of things. So I can't think that it wouldn't be their strategy to put money towards teacher salaries because they are seeing a real decrease in or a flight from the state of Alaska across all public employees, but in particular teachers as well, because we're just not that competitive anymore when you look at the total package. So while I can't guarantee you that the money is going to go to help teachers with their daily needs and their expenses and their families' needs, I cannot think of a better way to try to hold people and to keep people in districts than to provide more economic incentive for them to stay. And again, you know, there's a big difference between somebody that has been a part of the community, somebody that knows the families, that knows the community that they're part of, that's been there for a while. They not only do they increase their ability to teach through experience and by watching other experienced teachers, but the human connectivity thing, you know, it's a big deal. If the kid walks to the classroom and the teacher says, hey, you know, how's your mom and dad or your older brother? I just taught him 2 or 3 years ago. And how's he doing? And you just, you know, if you can make that human connection, oh, my goodness. You know, the things that you can do in relationship to actual teaching stuff is so much more powerful, so much more effective. And so, again, retaining teachers and taking advantage of their experience. And that's really what we talk about when we talk about improving outcomes. You know, that's going to make the difference. So getting off on a tangent there, Chair Ruffridge, but yeah, I can't think that if they get more resources made available to them, that a significant amount of those resources are going to go towards trying to keep, retain their teachers.
Thank you, Representative. One other question I had was in regards to I've been made aware, and obviously this is a relatively new endeavor for me to be on this education committee and be a representative in general. So some of these things come as a surprise to me when I find them. It seems that this legislature over the course of 20 to 25 years of work has worked themselves into mandating school districts to do a lot of different things, and those things have a cost associated with them. Have you done much in the way of looking at things that we might help them eliminate as far as the work burden that they're essentially mandated to do by this body, both past and present, to help reduce some of the cost burden on school districts?
Chair Ruffridge, to specifically say, have I done much thought or analysis on that particular question, I can honestly say no. But, you know, what I found in my now 9 years of being here, I'm in my ninth year, is that there's always a good cause or there's always a good task that we can put upon our schools. And when those things come up, who can argue against them? You know, we should do more to, and we should. We should do more to try to make our students better readers or more reader preparation. And so, you know, there's quite a bit of time and analysis that went into the Reads Act. And, you know, there's some really good things about the bill. However, I think that would be just the most recent example of an unfunded mandate, in essence, a good intention and a good overall piece of legislation. But there's no doubt that the Reads Act puts an increased financial burden on our teachers. And I hadn't heard that the teachers didn't already have enough on their plates already prior to that particular bill. I didn't hear that. Hey, we've been sitting around, haven't been doing much. Gosh darn, I'm glad we got this Reads Act because that just gives us something direction and gives us something to do. No, that's not the way it is for our teachers and for our administrators as well. So, and that's just the latest example. You know, a couple of years ago, we did some things with it wasn't domestic violence, but it was something about
Breeze law,
right? Very good, very important thing. Very important thing that we did. It was a good positive step, but again, it put an added burden on local districts to adjust to a very worthy cause and something that nobody could argue against, and it was needed, but. Again, it resulted in an unfunded mandate, and there were several before that, too. So, in essence, we're very good at providing added responsibilities and added tasks to our schools and to our staff, that the people that staff those schools. We're very good at that, and they're all good intentions. But I think we're, in the end, very good at providing unfunded mandates on them. So.
Yeah, thank you. And just as my follow-up to that, and frankly, you actually – segued quite well into my follow-up, which is I think there's a little bit of work needed, and I've been asking for information from districts, my own district included, and it would certainly be wonderful to get, you know, your help as the bill sponsor on that as well, to notice what is the funding requirement to make the Reads Act functional. And I think that goes a long way towards helping the conversation move forward in a way that says, we as the legislature passed a bill, and here is the most likely cost scenario to ensure that bill succeeds and we have our kids reading by third grade. Have you had any interactions with school districts in which they've given any sort of cost estimates to what it would take to fund the Reads Act?
Chair Ruffridge, only anecdotal, not any real specific analysis for my particular district, but I can tell you on a very personal basis, my own daughter is a reading specialist, and she has therefore looked at the regulations quite thoroughly, looked at the requirements that are coming down through the Reads Act, because she is a reading specialist, and it amounts to a number of assessments that take place once a student, yearly assessments that take place throughout the year to track progress, a very worthy endeavor to do. So they have to give them a number of assessments. They have to provide for those approximately, I think it's 70% of the students that are arriving, tests to the level that shows that they need some added help in becoming, reading grade level, et cetera. And they start assessing them as soon as they arrive in kindergarten, I believe. And then they, those go through the third grade. And then those assessments take place a number of times during the year. And they, not only that, but those students that test, that show that they are not up to speed where they should be, they have, the teacher has to provide, or in this case, my daughter would have to provide a individualized reading plan for each of those particular students. All that's good, but for her, there's no added compensation. It still falls within her regular teaching salary. To be a reading specialist in a school of her size, it's not like she's not busy. It's not like she doesn't do those things already. She might not write them out individually, but she's concerned. Teachers at the elementary level, if they're anything, they're very empathetic and very concerned about their teacher, about their students' progress. And so they do these things. There's some value in regular communication between parents that the new requirements through the REES Act require of teachers, et cetera. There's value in that, and that's all good. But in the end, it does certainly add to the workload without any added compensation, without any adjustments to those needs, et cetera. I probably went off on a tangent there, but in any case, she's concerned about some of the interactions that are required in the test as well, with parents that are dialed in and are very supportive of their students and know something about education and reading and things like that. No problem. That goes very well. But, the potential of some of that dialogue with some parents, she's concerned about that, about discussions around retention and those kinds of things. Ultimately, under the bill, retention is still left up to the parents, but the parents are provided quite a bit of information, and some may not be able to really clearly understand the positives and the negatives of what retention might mean and all those kinds of things. So it's complicated, but I do know that in the end it adds to the workload for sure. And I would say unequivocally that it is a mandate that's not fully funded.
Thank you. Representative Story, did you have a question?
Chair, if I might have permission to elaborate on if the BSA dollars will go towards salary and benefits for teachers.
Please.
Well, this is where I put my school board hat on. And as a school board member for 15 years with the Juneau School District, this school board member has not only been a fiduciary and budgeting job, it's also a political position like ours is. And parents want nothing more than to have the smallest class sizes they can have because they want their children to have that personal attention. And it's a real benefit. And so when the school board is deliberating and they get a certain budget, I can guarantee that if the BSA is increased, it's going to go to salaries and benefits and compensation for teachers because teachers have negotiations. They have three-year contracts. The teams that the school board negotiators, the district negotiators, and the teacher negotiators, they look at what compensation, it oftentimes goes to mediation because school board members are in a hard place because personnel in the Juneau School District is 85% of the budget. A lot of districts, 80% is probably the norm. So you're not going to be cutting things. You're going to be affecting your staff that informs instruction because you can't do the heating. There's just so many fixed costs, and we've been putting pressure on our budgets for a long time. And so school boards, they're oftentimes agonizing over what the increase can be, because they know they have a flat amount of money because they're not the appropriators. We are the appropriators for public education. They get a certain budget. They're not a taxing authority. And so that's the budget they get, and they have to make it all work. And when you increase salaries, you're going to have to cut maybe CTE, preschool, things that I'm always shocked at what school boards are cutting, because we all know those are good things that motivate students and help early learning, but they're between a rock and a hard place. And so then what happens is then it goes there, oftentimes that impasse, not that they don't want to, but they just have a limited amount of money. So then when they go to impasse and mediation, the mediators look at what is increased around the state. And so that is kind of what will need to happen in your district. And so then mediation, so the salaries and benefits as they should. And as we and our body, we just in the governor's budget, we've approved $31 million for all state employee contracts that we honor. But we recognize that that's a part of having employees. But with school boards, there is no, the only money that comes in is from the appropriation. And so we're going to have increases, and we should. I mean, costs are higher. Teachers are asked to do a lot. And so that's where revenue is going to go. And we know number one in-school factor that improves student learning is the expertise of their teachers. So we want to keep experienced teachers. We want to attract good, you know, people to come to Alaska. And this says we value education and that we're going to invest in it. And my question to the bill sponsor is, like, what state flat funds education for 7 years, 8 years, 10 years? Are we just supposed to, we're going to flat fund education because it's a large raw number, but when you adjust for cost of living, we're just below average of what we put, according to the Dr. DeFeo study, towards education. People aren't looking to come here. They used to look to come here in the 90s, where we funded higher and the cost of living and adjusted for that. And so I did want to also say that the School Boards Association and the Superintendents Association put together a list of unfunded mandates that they thought this body could address. It's a few years old now. We could ask them to update it. A lot of the things, again, that we want to fund here is like the REEDS Act. We want to help our school scores, but it costs a lot of money to do that. And I think you left off all the interventions that we'll be doing Saturday school and after school tutoring, and you need transportation to get your students to that. And there's a lot of really good intentions in there, but it needs some more revenue to be effective. And then also I think about the REEDS Act asks for culturally relevant assessments, professional development, curriculum for all of our students to do really well. And that takes intervention and attention to. So thank you for those.
Yes, comments. Thank you. And another document to please share with the committee if you have that. That would be great. Thank you. Representative Hemshue.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I'm not even really sure how to ask this question, so I'm just going to dive in. And through the chair, Representative Ortiz, you have a lot more experience in this building than I have in doing what we're here to do. The question that I have has to do with, for other divisions and departments, when we talk, so I've been in some budget subcommittees, can you give examples of where the legislature sets statute for them requiring things like plans that they'll write? Or the grain size I'm getting at is, in which other places do we legislate down to how people will spend their time doing their job within that department? Can you give other examples of that?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshue, you know, for a number of years, I served as the subfinance chair of the Fish and Game Committee and Fish and Game Department, sorry. And, you know, we have before us projects that are listed out. This assessment will take place in this particular region of Alaska, or this cost will, funding for this particular project will go to another project down in Southeast Alaska. And those budgets were initially drawn up by the agency themselves, by Fish and Game themselves. And then we look at them and we have some input as to, you know, which projects we wanted to maybe we're looking at. They were cutting, and then we said, no, that's an important project. We would like to fund that. So we increased the budget on several different occasions so that we could fund those particular projects that could be assessments that would be needed in order for a particular fishery to move forward. So in that sense, we were, by our appropriations, we were saying to the department, no, we need to do those things so that these things, these fisheries can happen. Or we maybe need to move the monies from this particular area over to another particular area so that that particular area can get some added support, etc. Let's, I'm talking about areas like a sports fish versus commercial fisheries division. So in that sense, there was a little bit of direction, if you will. However, those projects and those changes were resulted specifically because they came from the agency itself, and they said, well, this is the opportunity cost of dealing with money. This, we can do this, but we can't do this, or vice versa. So in essence, we weren't the ones that directed specifically. But I guess, you know, the Reeds Act, too, that didn't come from us. That came from Deed eventually. I mean, it came from Deed, I guess. So it wasn't like we were the ones that were dictating it specifically. So anyway, I guess it happens a little bit, but not to the level. But then again, you know, I mean, education is pretty important to people. And it dictates that it draws more attention from our constituents. You know, it's important that fish get fed or that fish are taken care of. But there's nobody there speaking for those fishies. But there's people speaking for for their students and for their kids, that's for sure. So it might be a little different, but... You know, certainly I get your point. We do, you know, we have a tendency to think that we know what's best from the legislative perspective, and I'm not sure that we always do. But nevertheless, you know, things happen, and for the most part, I think they're for good intentions, and obviously the Reeds Act has very good intentions behind it. So in any case, I did want to provide a little follow-up, Mr. Chair. I received word that there is, through the ASA, a survey that has now gone out to all the different districts as to what their projected costs are, what they will be in adjusting to the Reeds Act. And so hopefully we'll hear the results of that survey soon, and they'll be made available to everybody in the legislature, and of course, most specifically to the members of this committee, so that they can see, you know, what it is that the districts are projecting the added cost will be in relationship to the Reeds Act. So,
thank you, Representative Ortez. I will say one comment. Is there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none. My own school district has its budget meeting tonight. Their budget is due in April. And obviously, by statute, they're required to present a balanced budget to the Borough Assembly. They've presented an interesting picture to the people of the Kenai Peninsula School District. They have a projected deficit of $13 million. They're going to use up a large portion of their savings and remaining ESSER funds to bring that deficit down to $3 million. But their picture for our school district is increasing the pupil-teacher ratio in multiple schools by 3, in some cases 4.5. They're projecting to remove the managers of every pool, and I don't need to remind this committee that the Kenai Peninsula School District pools produced an Olympic gold medalist, so props to that, and as well as all of the technicians for our theaters and all of the athletic director positions. So it does definitely paints a picture for at least my school district, and I can't speak for any others, that the budget process is a difficult one, and we are tasking our school board members with very difficult decisions to make, and certainly does not go unnoticed by the folks in the Kenai Peninsula School District. So that was something that was sent to me over the weekend, and definitely is an attention-getting budget document. So I'm sure many of you on this committee have received similar ones from your own districts, but I wanted to share that for the record today. Is there any other comments or questions from the committee before we adjourn for the day? Is that a question, Representative McCormick? No. All right, seeing none, thank you, Representative Ortez, for bringing this back. We will set this bill aside, and we will get with you and set some time for public testimony as well as amendment deadlines at a later date. And seeing that we have nothing else, is there anything else for the good of the order? We have 10 minutes remaining in our committee time. All right, seeing none, this concludes the meeting then of the House Education Committee. And with no other business before us, we will adjourn until Wednesday. Let the record reflect that the time is 9:47.